Everyone is having a wonderful Monday night. We're rounding out today's track list of Recession Pop. Again, from 2008 to 2012, 2013. A horrible economy made for a great landscape of music. So while the price of eggs are pushing $9, here is Lady Gaga's new hit, Abracadabra. Good night. Keep your mind on the distance when the devil turns around.
Watch it burn.
This has been WRCT Pittsburgh. Thank you for listening. And tonight's show goes out to a special listener, Harley, all the way in North Dakota.
My back. When the darkness comes, I feel the grave, but I still believe. I still believe through the cold.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh, that has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true, and of course it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. Whether, and that's, so you, there you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
It wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgians did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English
Portuguese,
did that as well.
The
Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything. Mm-hmm. Commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, I was learning Spanish in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonized-colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you have the public school accent, meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants, and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got Le Parisien and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. It's not, that's not French. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African American, in the immigrant American community, are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South, but it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel, where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting, though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. There's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power, and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquests of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumene, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the populations
absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, or, and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop now, you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes, vous en avez dans ma taille. You can go either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example. You can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English, not necessarily all in the same rap, but
Potentially.
Yes. And often in multiples. And Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual a space is, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Right. Well, that's the whole question of register, of course, yes. You know, so that code switching between registers, my experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers, mm-hmm. There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited. Although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
Jock musicians apparently exist as well.
Jock musicians as well, absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows, yes. Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point too about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking, so it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or et cetera. But what's cool, what's so interesting is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone, because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persine, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who's emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge, which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course, but mm-hmm. That's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. And of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, mm-hmm. which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
It
can do a pastiche of Shakespeare and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Janie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby. I just made that up. I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed. Machines designed for plagiarizing, right? Yeah. They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even like Gabby et Jules and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening, but to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
Well, that's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How is that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. So, you know, I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles. But eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did, because I've been binge watching 5 seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
Yeah, right.
This is you. This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet? And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are. Yeah, but, okay. But just barely, right? I mean, you know, the fact is, we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. Now, that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even in international, between spaces who don't actually speak English, and of course speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample, where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a four-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today, because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself, I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears because the waitress had insulted their French in French. Mm-hmm. Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted, you know. So that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English. Mm-hmm. The moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accents speak, then she could get in and continue living French free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are and learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say, you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops
exactly,
different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important so that you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Oh, it was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016. Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regime scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of 0, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies. First of all, rich democracies never die. The wealthiest democracies ever to break down, Argentina and Hungary, both had a per capita GDP of about $17,000 in today's dollars. The U.S. is four times richer than that. Second seemingly rock-solid fact about democracies is that old democracies never die. No democracy over the age of 50 is ever broken down. Even if we date the birth of our democracy at 1965, when we achieved full suffrage, U.S. democracy was over 50 when Donald Trump was elected. so we ought to be safe. But we're not. And we argue that the United States is undergoing an unprecedented transition, an historic transition, a transition to a multiracial democracy in which a previously dominant group loses its dominant status. That, we argue, has triggered an authoritarian reaction among a minority of Americans. But that's only part of the story. Our Constitution, unfortunately, is exacerbating the problem by empowering that authoritarian minority. All right, to begin with, the United States is becoming a truly multiracial democracy. The U.S., as you all know, has become much more diverse and much more racially egalitarian over the last 60 years. The number of Black and Latino members of Congress has more than quadrupled since my bar mitzvah. I'm not that old. From 28 in 1980 to 114 today. The number of Latino members of Congress has increased from 9 to 55. The number of African Americans in Congress has increased from 19 to 60. For the first time in history, the percentage of African Americans in Congress, or the percentage of Congress that is African American, is now equal to the percentage of the overall population that is African American. In 1965, all 9 Supreme Court justices were white men. Today, 4 out of 9 are white men. Only 6 of 9 are white. Public opinion has also changed dramatically in the last half century. For the first time in the history of the Republic, a majority of Americans now embrace the core principles of multiracial democracy: ethnic diversity and racial equality. Some examples. In 1980, a majority of Americans opposed laws to ban discrimination in home sales. Today, 80% of Americans support laws banning discrimination in home sales. In the 1990s, most Americans consistently opposed affirmative action. Today, more than 60% of Americans tell Gallup they support affirmative action and greater workplace diversity. More than 60% of Americans now consistently agree with the statement that the growing diversity of our society makes America a better place to live. And a recent poll, I think from last year, found that more than 60% of Americans think our schools should teach kids about America's history of racism, even if it makes kids uncomfortable. This is a big deal. For the first time in history, America has a multiracial democratic majority. But our transition to multiracial democracy confronts 2 major challenges. I want to talk about these today. First, an authoritarian reaction, and second, a constitution that is amplifying that reaction. I want to take each of those points in turn. First of all, most fundamentally, United States democracy is in crisis today because one of our 2 major parties is no longer committed to playing by democratic rules of the game. Political parties that are committed to democracy, what the great political scientist Juan Linz called loyal Democrats, small d Democrats, loyal Democrats, parties that are committed to democracy must do 3 things. And this is taken from Linz. They must unambiguously accept the results of elections, win or lose. They must unambiguously reject the use of violence. And they must break completely with anti-democratic extremists. First 2 are pretty straightforward, so I want to develop the 3rd point, breaking with anti-democratic extremists. Single leaders, as powerful, as demagogic as they may seem, cannot kill a democracy on their own. They need accomplices among mainstream politicians. These are what Linz called semi-loyal Democrats. Again, small d Democrats. Semi-loyal Democrats can be hard to identify in a crowd. They look, they talk like regular politicians. The real litmus test, the way to distinguish a semi-loyal Democrat from a committed Democrat, is how they respond to the emergence of anti-democratic extremists in their own camp, on their own flank. When anti-democratic forces emerge on their own flank, loyal Democrats do 4 things. They publicly and unambiguously condemn anti-democratic behavior, even if it's done by their allies. They expel anti-democratic extremists from their ranks. They refuse to, say, nominate them for public office or support their candidacies. They cease all activities, both private and public, with groups that engage in anti-democratic behavior, and crucially, they join forces, or they're willing to join forces, with pro-democratic rivals from across the political and ideological spectrum to isolate and defeat anti-democratic extremists. This is Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Semi-loyal Democrats do none of these things. Rather than publicly repudiate anti-democratic behavior on their own flank, they downplay that behavior. They justify it through whataboutism or simply remain silent. Rather than expelling anti-democratic extremists, semi-loyalists tolerate them, accommodate them, sometimes even nominate them. And crucially, semi-loyalists refuse to work with ideological rivals to defeat anti-democratic extremists, even when democracy is on the line. In other words, they choose their anti-democratic allies over their pro-democratic rivals. Now, semi-loyalists may appear relatively benign. These guys aren't actively trying to kill democracy. They're just regular politicians trying to get ahead, trying to, say, become House Speaker, or regain a Senate majority, maybe stave off a primary challenge, avoid the wrath of the base. But history tells us that semi-loyal behavior inevitably strengthens anti-democratic forces. So when mainstream politicians tolerate or condone anti-democratic extremists, it normalizes them. Mainstream media outlets start to interview them like any other politician. Donors who once shunned them decide that it's okay to contribute to their campaigns. Leading consultants and pollsters start to return their phone calls. And politicians who once kept a distance now decide it might be okay to join them. All of that empowers and emboldens anti-democratic forces. A clear lesson from democratic breakdowns in Europe in the 1930s and in Latin America in the 1960s and 70s is that when mainstream political parties of the center left or the center right start to flirt or cooperate with extremists, democracies get into trouble. Since 2020, the Republican Party has violated all three of these principles of loyal democratic behavior. Not only was Donald Trump the first U.S. president in history to try to overturn an election, but crucially, the bulk of the Republican Party went along with it. A group called the Republican Accountability Project, a group of conservative never-Trumpers, evaluated the public statements of all 261 Republican members of Congress in the aftermath of the 2020 election to see whether they publicly cast doubt on the legitimacy of the 2020 election. 86% of them cast doubt on the election. This is crucial. Democracy requires that parties know how to lose. It's the cardinal rule of democracy. When a major party cannot accept defeat, democracy's in trouble. Republican politicians, or some of them, have also begun to flirt with political violence. They've embraced individuals, for example, who threatened or killed Black Lives Matter protesters. The McCloskeys, remember the McCloskeys? The St. Louis couple that drew their guns on unarmed protesters were given a prominent speaking role in the Republican convention. Marjorie Taylor Greene nominated Kyle Rittenhouse. Remember Kyle Rittenhouse? Nominated him for a congressional gold medal. And during the 2022 primary season, the New York Times found more than 100 Republican ads in which candidates brandished or fired guns. I can think of no other major political party in any established democracy in which candidates so openly embraced violence. But the most dangerous feature of the contemporary Republican Party is its pervasive semi-loyalty. Republican leaders knew that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, and most of them in private were deeply troubled by his effort to overturn the results. But they enabled it anyway. They protected Trump by refusing to impeach and convict him. They blocked creation of an independent commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection, and nearly all of them say they will back Trump in 2024, even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election. It does not have to be this way. Think about what happened recently in Brazil. Brazilians, as most of you know, elected a Trump-like figure, Jair Bolsonaro, in 2018. The U.S. media called him the Trump of the tropics. Bolsonaro governed a lot like Trump. He governed pretty badly. And like Trump, he narrowly lost his re-election bid in 2022. And like Trump, he tried to overturn the results. But his own political allies refused to go along with it. All major right-wing politicians in Brazil publicly recognized the opposition candidate Lula's victory on election night. The president of Congress, all the leading governors in the country recognized the results of the election. In other words, the McConnells, the McCarthys, the DeSantises of Brazil, all of them unambiguously accepted the results of the elections on election night. Brazil had a January 6th-like event on January 8th, 2023. Protesters stormed the Congress, the Supreme Court building, the presidential palace. But the Brazilian right uniformly condemned the insurrection. Nobody downplayed it. Nobody condoned it. Nobody defended it. In fact, right-wing politicians in Brazil pushed for a congressional investigation into the events of January 8th. And finally, whereas Republicans plan to back Trump even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election, the Brazilian courts barred Bolsonaro from running for the next 8 years, and conservative politicians have accepted that. They have not responded by attacking the legitimacy of the judicial system in Brazil. Bolsonaro is now an increasingly marginal figure in Brazilian politics. So there was another path. Republican leaders simply didn't pursue it. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that all Republicans are authoritarian. Many, many, in fact, millions of Republicans across the country are committed to democracy. But a failure to unambiguously accept election results, a flirtation with violence, and support for an openly authoritarian candidate are all clear signs of a political party that is no longer committed or fully committed to democratic rules of the game. So why is this happening? Why would an established political party like the Republicans, a party that's been competing peacefully in elections for more than 150 years, turn away from democracy? Again, in democracies, parties have to be able to live with losing. For parties to live with losing, for parties to tolerate losing, they have to believe that losing will not bring ruinous consequences. When parties or their supporters perceive losing to pose an existential threat, they tend to radicalize. They tend to try to win at any cost. In other words, we argue that it is an outsized fear of losing that leads parties to turn away from democracy. Think about the Southern Democrats after the Civil War. This is if anyone accuses me of not being bipartisan, I'm going to rag on the Democrats. Reconstruction was this country's first experiment with multiracial democracy. It brought immediate and widespread black enfranchisement. African Americans were an outright majority or a near majority in most Southern states, most post-Confederate states. So their enfranchisement terrified Southern Democrats and their supporters. Not only did black suffrage threaten the Southern Democrats' electoral dominance, it threatened to overturn the entire racial order in the South. And for many Southern whites, that felt like an existential threat. So the Democrats abandoned any pretense of democracy. As one North Carolina Democrat put it, we cannot outnumber the Negroes. And so we must either out-cheat, out-count, or out-shoot them. And that's what they did. The Democrats used a combination of violent terrorism and election fraud to seize power across the South. They then entrenched themselves in power by using poll taxes, literacy tests, and other measures to wipe out African-American voting rights. Unwilling to lose, Southern Democrats stripped the right to vote from nearly half the population, ushering in nearly a century of authoritarian rule in the U.S. South. We fear that something similar, or at least parallel, is happening to the Republican Party today. The Republicans are a party of a majority ethnic group, white Christians, whose electoral and social dominance began to be threatened in the early 21st century. And the origins of that dynamic lie in the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1950s and the 1960s. That, the Civil Rights Revolution, was America's second experiment with multiracial democracy. When the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, the Republicans were very clearly a minority party. They had been since the New Deal. But the Democrats' embrace of civil rights over the course of the 1960s and 70s alienated many of their racially conservative white voters. And that was especially true in the South, where the vast majority of white voters were Democrats. That fact, the alienation of many white racially conservative voters, created a political opportunity for the Republicans. So beginning with Goldwater, continuing with Nixon and with Reagan, the Republicans pretty systematically for about 20 years appealed to white resentments. And that strategy worked pretty well. Southern whites, over the course of 30 or 40 years, went from being overwhelmingly Democrats to being overwhelmingly Republicans. And the Republicans, over the course of the latter part of the 20th century, established themselves quite effectively as the party of self-identified white Christians. They've won the white vote in every presidential election since 1968. Because 80% of Americans self-identified as white and Christian in the 1970s and 80s, the Republicans achieved quite a bit of electoral success with this strategy. They ceased to be a minority party. In fact, the Republicans won every single presidential election between 1968 and 1988, except for the Watergate election of 1976. But the strategy eventually ran into trouble. Because while the Republicans were becoming America's white Christian party, America was becoming less white and less Christian. The percentage of Americans who identified as white and Christian fell from 80% in 1976 to 43% in 2016. That had a couple of implications for the Republicans. First of all, it posed an electoral challenge. A reliance on white Christian votes made it hard, not impossible, but made it harder for the Republicans to win national majorities in the 21st century. In fact, the Republican Party has not won the popular vote since 2004. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won 55% of the white vote, translated that into a landslide election victory. 32 years later, 2012, Mitt Romney won a whopping 59% of the white vote, still lost. When Republicans realized they were winning the white vote but losing the American vote, they started to panic. And that's when we saw the first, at least in the recent era, state-level efforts to make it harder for people to register and vote, 2011, 12, 13. But the problem went way beyond just losing elections. For a part of the Republican base, the rise of multiracial democracy felt like an existential threat. Because white Christians were not just any group. They were historically a dominant group. They sat atop all of the country's social hierarchies, right? For two centuries, every single president, every vice president, every House Speaker, every Senate Majority Leader, every Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, every Federal Reserve Chair, every Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a white man. All the way through my bar mitzvah, every single governor, every single Fortune 500 CEO, every flippin' Miss America was white. All of that is now ending rapidly, relentlessly, right before our eyes. We see it in the quadrupling in the number of Black and Latino members of Congress since the 1980s. We see it in the growing presence of non-white and multiracial families on our TV screens and ads and movies. We see it in mounting societal pushback against acts of racism. Think of the Black Lives Matter protests. And we see it in challenges in classrooms, in newsrooms, to historical narratives that downplay or ignore America's racist past. We are witnessing, in our lifetimes, an unprecedented assault on this country's racial hierarchies. But when your group is on top of the hierarchy, challenges to that hierarchy can feel threatening. Losing one's dominant social status can generate feelings of loss, of resentment. It can feel like an existential threat. Many Trump voters, not all, many Trump voters feel like they're losing their country. They feel like the country they grew up in is being taken away from them. And that sense of loss has pushed many rank-and-file Republicans toward extremism. In a survey taken 2 years ago, 56% of Republicans agreed with the statement that the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. 56%. Now, the Republicans' radicalization would pose much less of a threat if the United States were like other democracies, where electoral majorities govern. In just about every Western democracy, there are 20, 25, maybe 30% of voters who sympathize with what we call far-right positions. But in no other established democracy has that 25 or 30% translated into so much political power. Again, Trump and MAGA have never, not for a day, represented a majority of Americans. Surveys show that majorities of Americans, again, embrace the principles of multiracial democracy. America now has a multiracial democratic majority. But that majority has hurled itself against some of the world's most powerful counter-majoritarian institutions. Now, let me be clear. Counter-majoritarian institutions are a mouthful. They are also essential to democracy. Modern democracy requires the protection of minority rights. Not everything can or should be up for grabs in an election. As Justice Robert Jackson famously put it, some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities. I want to suggest that two domains in particular absolutely must be placed beyond the realm or the reach of majorities. The first is civil rights. Civil liberties like the right to vote, free speech, freedom of association, assembly, freedom of conscience must be protected from the whims of the majority. Pretty obvious. A second domain that must be beyond the reach of majorities is the democratic process itself. Elected governments can't be able to use popular or parliamentary majorities to entrench themselves in power. For example, by changing the rules of the game to undermine competition or weaken their opponents. That's the kind of tyranny of the majority that we saw in Chavez's Venezuela, with Orban in Hungary, and with Netanyahu's judicial reform in Israel. So we need to have, every democracy must have mechanisms to protect the democratic system from majorities that would subvert it. So civil liberties and the right to fair competition are essential minority rights. They are rights that require counter-majoritarian institutions. So institutions like the U.S. Bill of Rights, an independent judiciary with some review power, and relatively high barriers to constitutional reform, these are what I would call essential counter-majoritarian institutions. But not all counter-majoritarian institutions are essential to democracy. In fact, some of them subvert democracy. So just as some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities, other domains, I would argue, must remain within the reach of majorities. And let me just mention two. One of them is elections. Those with more votes should prevail over those with fewer votes in determining who holds political office. To my knowledge, no theory of liberal democracy justifies any other outcome. A second domain that ought to remain within the realm of majorities is legislation. Those who win elections should govern. Partisan minorities should not be able to permanently veto legislation that's backed by parliamentary majorities, provided that legislation doesn't violate basic rights. Institutions that prevent electoral majorities from winning or that prevent parliamentary majorities from governing are not essential to democracy. In fact, they are antithetical to democracy. The U.S., it turns out, has an unusual number of these undemocratic institutions. The Electoral College, which allows losers of the popular vote to win the presidency. A severely malapportioned Senate that provides equal representation to all states regardless of their population. The Senate filibuster, which is not part of the Constitution, but allows a partisan minority to permanently block legislation backed by a majority. And, of course, a powerful Supreme Court with lifetime tenure for justices, which allows justices appointed in one generation to thwart majorities for generations to come.
You're listening to Stephen Levitsky, Tyranny of the Minority. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, undemocratic counter-majoritarian institutions are often a product of transitional political pacts. Pacts in which powerful authoritarian forces demand special protections in exchange for giving up power. We saw this, for example, in post-Pinochet Chile, We saw it with the Polish communists in 1989. We saw it with whites in South Africa. We see it with the military in contemporary Thailand. In all these cases, authoritarian forces demanded extra protection, a sort of leg up in exchange for giving up power. Now, we don't usually think of the United States, of our counter-majoritarian institutions, in these way, right? We usually think of our counter-majoritarian institutions as a product of far-sighted design. We think of it as part of a carefully crafted blueprint for checks and balances. That, I want to suggest, is in large part a myth. The framers of the U.S. Constitution were very smart folks, but they weren't out there trying to design the perfect republic. They were trying to hold the Union together and prevent a descent into civil war or foreign military intervention. And to do that, to prevent a breakup of the Union and a descent into violence, they realized very quickly that they had to compromise. Madison and Hamilton, two of our most brilliant framers, opposed equal state representation in the Senate. But when small states threatened to bolt the Union, they had to compromise. Madison wanted the Congress to select the president, like contemporary parliamentary systems in Europe. And he, Madison himself, preferred direct presidential elections to the Electoral College. But Madison's Virginia plan, which would have the Congress elect the president, was voted down. And Southern slave states rejected direct elections. So the Electoral College ended up being a sort of third best solution after all the other alternatives were voted down. The filibuster was also not part of the framers' vision for checks and balances. Both Hamilton and Madison strongly opposed supermajority rules for regular legislation. Supermajority rules were not included in the Constitution, not for regular legislation. They were not included in the original Senate. The filibuster emerged later thanks to a sort of weird oversight by early 19th century Senate leaders who were cleaning up the chamber's rules. And it wasn't until late in the 20th century that it actually became a supermajority rule on all legislation. So key counter-majoritarian institutions, things like the Senate and the Electoral College, were not a product of far-sighted design. They were a product of transitional pacts. But whereas transitional pacts in Poland, in Chile, in South Africa were temporary, America's counter-majoritarian institutions, for the most part, became permanent features of our political system. And those permanent features, I want to suggest, now threaten our democracy. The concessions made to small states in 1787 built a bias into our political system. It overrepresented sparsely populated territories. So the Electoral College favors sparsely populated states. The U.S. Senate heavily favors sparsely populated states. And because the Senate approves Supreme Court nominees, the Supreme Court is also mildly biased towards sparsely populated states. That rural bias has always been with us. It's always been undemocratic. But it never seriously advantaged one political party over another because for most of this country's history, both major parties had urban and rural wings. So it didn't really have a partisan effect. It's only in the early 21st century that U.S. parties have split markedly along urban-rural lines. Today, Democrats are overwhelmingly based in metropolitan centers, while Republicans are overwhelmingly based in more sparsely populated territories, smaller towns. That gives the Republicans, through no fault of their own, a systematic advantage in the Electoral College, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, which allows them, importantly, to win and hold national power without winning national electoral majorities. The Republicans have won the popular vote for president once since 1988. They've controlled the presidency for most of the 21st century. A popular majority was not enough for Joe Biden to win the presidency in 2020. He had to win by 4 points. Had he won by 3 percentage points, Trump would have been reelected. The Senate is even more skewed. In recent years, the Democrats have needed to win the popular vote in the Senate by about 5 points to retain control. So even if the Democrats consistently win 51, 52% of the national vote for the Senate, the Republicans will control the Senate. Senators, as you know, are elected to staggered 6-year terms. So a third of the chamber is up for election every 2 years. That means it takes 3 elections over a 6-year cycle to fully elect or renovate the Senate. The Democratic Party has won the overall popular vote in every 6-year cycle since 2000. And yet the Republicans have